Good afternoon. So last time we started out by giving corrected version of how we implemented binary semaphores with counting semaphores, and then we talked more about monitors, about the general pattern we have for this locks plus condition variables, where our condition variables represented a queue of threads waiting for something to become true. So typically we'd have some reason we're waiting for, we'd have a condition variable corresponding to each reason, and we'd have a loop checking if is that reason true and waiting on the condition variable and the waiting threads. And threads which would stop other threads from waiting would broadcast or signal when that reason may have changed as far as whether it's true or not. We mentioned that monitors allow certain kinds of sloppiness. Since we have this sort of built-in spurious wake-ups, which we learned, kind of is just because we aren't strictly enforcing that when you signal a thread, it's the next to get the lock, that we're going to have them pretty much regardless of whether the threading library tries to avoid that, unless it can hand off locks, which we learned doesn't happen. So you can signal or broadcast more than you need, so producing correct code might not be the same as producing code that wakes up threads the least amount of times. But like it at least means you have a straightforward path to, I want to wait for this to become true. How can I make sure this is correct? And then we can worry about, can I signal instead of broadcast to make it faster and so on. We talked about, after we went through our producer-consumer example, another common pattern we see with threads, which was reader-writer locks. And the idea there was that we'd have multiple readers at once, so you want multiple threads to be able to read, but only one thread to be able to write, which means that readers need to wait if someone's writing, writers need to wait if someone's reading or writing, and we saw a way of implementing that with monitors, where we had a condition variable for to the two reasons to wait, waiting because I need there to be no writers or no readers and writers, and broadcasting or signaling on them when things change. And we saw this problem that we had this choice of priorities where sometimes we would favor readers or writers. And when we did the naive thing, we just got something random, whatever the lock was given to first, which we didn't really have any guarantees about what would happen. And we learned that we had this general idea that we could just make our choice by tracking the information we needed to know who should go. And that was, for example, for making sure writers go first, track the number of waiting writers, and if there's a waiting writer, we say, well, you reader might be able to get the lock, but that doesn't mean you should go yet because some writer is waiting. Give up the lock, let the writer go. Okay. So any questions about these things from last time? Okay, so some logistical notes before I move on. So I'm gone next week, Wednesday through Friday. So I will not be having office hours then, and Professor Kwan will cover this lecture. Also, the thread pool homework is released. So these are just two logistical notes. So if you plan on attending my office hours next week, it better be Monday, because I won't be there on Wednesday or Friday, and we'll have lecture coverage. Professor Kwan happens to be gone Monday through Wednesday of the week, so I'm covering Professor Kwan's lecture on Tuesday. Things will go on as normal otherwise. And that also means, logistically, there will probably not be a screen capture of this lecture next week. There should be audio, but no guarantees. Technical difficulties might happen. But probably not a screen capture. Okay, so finished talking about reader-writer priority. So we saw our example of writer priority, where we track the number of waiting writers and use that to make a decision about, well, readers should wait not just until there are no writers, but till no one's waiting to write. And we also use this to avoid signaling readers when they wouldn't be able to go anyways because writers were still waiting. And we could do the opposite and have readers go first where we'd track the number of waiting readers, and we'd say, writers only go when there's no readers, or writers, or readers that are waiting. And again, we could remember, okay, if there's waiting readers, it doesn't make sense to signal a writer, so only in the case where there isn't do we do that. And we can apply this pattern more generally. So if you want to create something that looks like a lock but has some choice about who goes when, you can keep track of other information. You just need to figure out a way of writing who can go now based on that information. And note that, like, we've just had these counters, but you could do a lot more than that. You could, like, have just a list of threads that you track yourself and say, and every thread like knows its number on the list, like you can do things at that level of granularity. Obviously that's gonna be more work for you and probably a little slower, but if you really care about the order in which things happen, that's what you do. And since we've looked at reader-writer locks, let's just review sort of our writer priority version. So here we track the number of writers, the number of readers, and the number of waiting writers. So let's see what happens here. We have reader one comes, then reader two, then writer one, then reader three. And let's watch what happens here just to like help you step through this. So the first thing which happens is our reader one comes. It enters the read lock function. And then it checks, is the writers equal to zero, not equal to zero, and waiting writers not equal to zero. While that's true, writers equals zero. I used a different condition for no reason. Okay. No, I used the same condition. So while there are no writers and no waiting writers, well, there's not zero writers and not zero. Yeah, so this is what I get for people not debugging my code. So this should be an or, because we want to wait while there's no writers, while there's any writers or any waiting writers, we want to wait. And for somehow I didn't catch this and no one noticed it. Okay. And that means that I should change the condition here, should be an or. So while there's no writers, and no waiting writers, we want to keep waiting. While there's a writer or a waiting writer, we wait. And we find out here that, there's zero writers and zero waiting writers, we shouldn't be waiting. So we don't wait. And instead, we increment the number of readers. So you say, there's a reader. And note that this is a thing which is not obvious. Even though we call this read lock, the lock we use to implement it, we only keep while we're manipulating this information. This is the information, this is what the lock variable is for. Is only to protect changing that information, make sure that's consistent. That we aren't reading it while it's being changed, we aren't writing it while someone's reading it. That's what the lock is for. So once we've incremented the number of readers and set it to one, we are done. We aren't manipulating this information here, so we release that lock we use to implement this bigger lock. And the thread which calls read lock presumably will be at this point actually doing some reading. And we're doing reading without holding that lock. And that means that another thread can call read lock and can acquire the lock. And it's going to do the same thing. It's going to increment the number of readers to 2. And that thread is then going to start reading. Then our writer is going to go and say, okay, I need to start waiting. And it's going to say that because it's going to say, well, are there no readers and writers? And the answer is, oops, well, there are. It looks at readers plus writers is 2, that's not 0, so it's going to wait. But before it waits, it set the number of waiting writers up to 1. So that means that later on, while it's waiting, our read lock here is going to know to wait. So here, this read lock, it's going to say, okay, there was a, here this is going to say, waiting writers is not equal to 0. So it's going to keep waiting, even though no one is writing yet. So then our reader's finished. So we call read unlock, we acquire the lock, which is not being held because the two threads that are waiting are just not holding the lock while they're waiting. That's how condition variables work. So that's gonna decrement the number of readers. We're gonna do that again. And when it becomes 0, we're gonna signal, oh, it's okay to write now. And that's going to wake up our writer, and it's going to double check, is readers plus writers still equal to, not equal to 0? And it's going to flip itself from waiting to not waiting to writing by changing the counts of waiting writers and writers. So, questions here? Yes?
General question. So if we have this while loop, how do we end up unlocking the lock after it anyways? Like, don't we need to unlock the lock in writer 1, like before reader 3 can go, but if we're in that while.
So the question is, how are we unlocking the lock so readers could have changed?
Yeah.
And the answer is that cond wait does that.
Okay.
That while we're waiting, we don't have the lock anymore.
Okay. So cond wait would unlock the lock and then lock it again before you get back to.
Yes, so cond wait releases the lock while you're waiting and gets back the lock before it returns. And this is because, well, if we're waiting on something, we better not be locking the thing that protects it from being changed. And cond wait is designed for that. Yes, and this is one of the big reasons I'm going through this example is that that's a very important thing to understand, is that it's okay for this read unlock to go here while people are waiting, because while they're waiting, they've released the lock, even though we don't have an unlock call to do it, cond wait does that for us. And this is why cond wait takes 2 arguments, the condition variable and the lock, to unlock. Yeah?
When you do cond signal, does it ever run, like, does it switch right away, or does it run the unlock from the method?
So the question is, when you do cond signal, does it switch right away? This is not specified when it switches. It makes it runnable. In a typical implementation, this might mean that it doesn't run until the scheduler next runs. As for whether how this deals with locking, if you cond signal while you have the lock, then the thing you signaled can't acquire the lock until you release it. But cond signal doesn't change that. And because we said cond wait is going to get the lock back before it returns, that means cond wait won't return, even if the thread like maybe gets to run to try starting acquiring the lock, it won't return until you release the lock. Other questions? Okay, then our write lock finally finishes, so our writer now, without holding the lock, can do reading and writing, and that's okay because we've indicated someone is writing, so if anyone else tries to access the data and calls read lock or write lock, they'll get back, hey, someone's that's busy, and it won't return until done. Then we write unlock, and it's going to say, are there still waiting writers? And the answer is no, so it's going to signal on the okay to read condition variable, which is going to wake up our reader, which is going to start return before it releases the lock. It's going to increment the number of readers. So later on, if someone else comes and asks to write, they'll find out, can't do that right now. So any questions about the procedure here? And yeah.
Could you get in a situation where you have like a reader that is reading in an infinite loop and then you're never able to write or something like that?
So the question is, can you get into a situation where the reader keeps the read lock forever? Absolutely. Like, the code we wrote doesn't require you to actually call read lock or read unlock or write unlock. So that's not something we're enforcing, is that anyone ever calls read unlock or write unlock, and if they don't, well, that's going to prevent people from writing. And this is the same as with normal locks. Like, if you just think of a mutex, if you call mutex lock and never call mutex unlock, well, no one's going to make any progress. Other questions? So, another thing we might say is, we can look at this idea of reader and writer priority, and we can try to extend that. So let's say in this case there were multiple waiting writers. Which one would get woken up first? And the answer right now is whatever either gets signaled or whatever gets the lock first, just however that happens to work out. But we could instead make an explicit choice. So let's say I wanted to have it be guaranteed that if you start waiting to write first, you're the first to write. How could I implement that? That I don't want it to be subject to the whims of whatever pthread con signal and con wait do and mutex lock do. I want to guarantee that if I can tell you started waiting first, that you are the first to write. So what information should I track? So it's not going to be enough to just keep track of the number of waiting writers. And to help work through this, you might remember that previously write lock was waiting for readers plus writers equals zero. And we're going to have to change that condition. So what should we change it to make this work? There's multiple solutions here. I'll give you 30 seconds. So does someone have a suggestion or something we could do? There, you? Yeah.
Maybe every time a writer tries to write lock, we could push a condition for that writer onto a stack or something.
Okay, so your idea is like a queue of, what do you mean by condition variables?
Yeah.
Okay. Of condition variable. So, tricky part here. So this is a reasonable idea. There's a bit of a trickiness, which is that the writer needs to still do while something wait on that condition variable. So what's this something going to be? I like this idea, but we need something to put in that while loop that will make sense. Okay, so we could have like a queue of, you know, next writer dot head doesn't equal me, you know, however I identify myself. Yeah, so that's one possible solution. So there's some simpler things you could do which are less efficient. So one in probably the simplest scheme that works but wakes up writers too often, or more often than you might like, is we could just keep a serial number and say, I'm writer number 1, 2, 3, and the next writer to go, while my number is not the next to go, keep waiting. and then we broadcast, but then we don't have separate condition variables, so we're waking up everyone. They're all checking, am I the next to go? And going back to sleep. But this queue idea is sort of the efficient thing, and this is a thing you might do. So here's my sort of pseudocode idea for it. That if we represent a waiting writer, I have a condition variable and a boolean, are we ready? And a writer, when it starts waiting, it allocates one of these, sets its ready to false, waits for the ready to become true, and then whoever wakes up writers by finishing reading or finishing writing is going to set the ready to true and signal that condition variable. So that's one possible solution, sort of. Another, like, more radical idea, you could say, is, you know, I don't like this write lock, read lock, write unlock API. Instead, we're gonna just, you know, instead of that, we're gonna, you know, submit a writing task, and we're gonna have a queue of the things to do and just have a thread which goes through them in order, using our producer-consumer pattern. And this, by the way, is very similar to the sort of thing you're gonna do for the next homework, which is a thread pool. Thread pool is a bunch of threads that are all working off a queue of tasks. So it's this kind of pattern, except you will have more than one thread doing it, so it won't be for the synchronization reasons, but this is a common kind of pattern you might see. But this is probably our more typical solution, given the problems had write lock and keeping the write lock. Okay, so questions about what I've done here. So we've talked about using monitors to build primitives and semaphores to build sort of when we want to do locking. And now I'm gonna go on to our sort of last major threading topic, which is about when things don't work out so well. So a certain class of threading bugs known as deadlock. And I'm gonna start with a more human example, and that's, let's say we have a one-way bridge here, and what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna say I want to have these cars drive autonomously, and we're gonna just say, the way we figure out, make sure that we're not colliding into each other, is we're gonna reserve the segment of road in front of us. So the cars are gonna reserve the two segments of road in front of them. They know no one else is using them. We get that lock, we're great. And then we advance, and then we can't keep going. So this kind of problem is known as a deadlock, where both cars want to get this piece of road, and they both can't get it, the piece of road in front of them, until the car which wants the piece of road they're on moves. So we have this sort of circular dependency that no one can go, that the black car can't go until the yellow car goes, and the yellow car can't go until the black car goes, as long as they're both really committed to going across the bridge. So this is sort of a classic, simple example of deadlock. There are also some more subtle ones. So a classic sort of thought problem on deadlock is the so-called dining philosopher's problem. So we have five philosophers sitting at a table, and we're using chopsticks. So they have chopsticks on either side of them, but there's only five of them because we're bad at setting tables. And so they're either thinking or eating, and when they're eating, they're gonna first grab one chopstick, then the other. So let's say everyone decides to eat at the same time. So everyone's gonna grab the chopstick on their left side. And then they're gonna try to grab this chopstick on their right side and find out it's not there. This is another example of this deadlock problem, that everyone is waiting for someone else to act. And it ends up that they're basically waiting on each other, that this philosopher can't go until this one goes, until this one goes, until this one goes, until this one goes, until the first one goes. We have this circular dependency, which is a key part of what this problem is. So these were just two toy examples. And you might have some complaints about these examples that, gosh, there are like real solutions to this problem that we do in real life. You know, if I'm driving across a bridge, I'm not just going to sit there and say, well, you're going to move eventually. which is what we're saying here. And if I'm eating with this too few chopsticks situation, I'm not just going to say, well, I'm going to wait till you put that down. But the issue is that when we have the computer code equivalent of this, that's not going to be something that is going to be written in our code unless we write it. That sort of logic. And deadlock also occurs commonly in real code, but obviously doesn't quite look like this. So, and we saw one example of this earlier when we talked about pipes. That here I have a child and a parent. They're communicating, they have a pipe from in each direction, and if both decide to write first and then read first, they're both waiting on each other. That the child is waiting to finish writing to the parent, and the parent's waiting to finish writing to the child, but they can't finish those writes until the other reads, but the others will never read because they're both waiting to do their own writes. So this is an example of a more realistic situation where you come up with a deadlock. It's common to try to write code something like this and find out that it hangs. Because you're both waiting for each other to finish before you move on and read. So we have the child's writing to the pipe, waiting for some free buffer space, but that buffer space will be free when the parent reads. The parent's writing to a pipe, it's going to wait for some free buffer space that will be freed when the child reads. And so we have this waiting loop. And we're going to have a way of representing these sorts of dependencies as, not surprisingly, a graph. So here's one way of representing the situation I just showed, that the parent process is waiting for space to write on the pipe buffer from parent to child, and the child process is waiting for space to write on the child to parent pipe buffer. And we have this sort of dotted line which says, well, that space will be available when the owner of the space, the parent that's being written to, in this case over here, or the child that's being written to, reads it and frees up that space. And if you look at this graph, you can see we have what we call a circular dependency, that the child's waiting for the parent's waiting for the child, even though we don't sort of have a very explicit waiting operation. So questions about what happens here? And I hope that this example illustrates how you could accidentally write code which has this kind of problem, this circular waiting issue. Now, we just talked about synchronizing threads, and we had these things like locks, and locks are probably a more common case where you'll have these sorts of circular dependencies. And it might be hard, given the sorts of examples we've shown, to imagine how that would happen. And this is because, well, we've been using simpler systems, where typically there's like one lock, and, well, one lock is generally not enough to have this scenario. We need two things in our cycle. And where these occur in real life is usually when you have multiple components. I'm going to give an example of sort of a pattern which you might happen more naturally with locks that will do this. So here I'm representing directories. And the way I'm representing a directory in memory is I have a map of the entries key by name in that directory, and I have a lock to make sure that if two threads are trying to access the same directory, only one does it at a time. Okay. Seems reasonable. I have a lock for every directory because I want to make sure that if I have two programs accessing different directories, that they don't need to wait for each other. Like, that wouldn't make sense. So every directory has their own lock, so I can have program in one directory and a program in another directory, act on their own, use the full core, not wait for each other. So here I have my move file from one directory to another operation. It's a common thing you might want to do. And I'm modifying the list of directory entries in two directories, and I don't want to have this state in the middle where the file's not in either directory or it's in both directories. I want it to either be in one directory or the other. So I don't want anyone to be looking at the directory entries before I've moved it from directory A, in this case, to B, you know, from or to. So what I do is I lock the from directory, I lock the to directory to make sure no one's looking while I'm modifying the list of entries. And then I copy the entry from the from directory to the to directory and erase the from directory's entry. And then I unlock the locks I had. So this method makes sense. Any questions about this problem setup? And we can run into a problem with this. And here's one example of a problem with two threads. If I run these two things at the same time, where A, I move from directory A to B, foo, and move from directory B to A, bar, at the same time, we have bad things can happen. Now, you might say, well, I mean, that could work out fine, because it can. So for example, let's say thread A happens to run just before thread B, thread 2, thread 1 before thread 2. So thread A acquires A's lock, A directory's lock, B directory's lock, does the move operation, releases the locks, then thread B runs, everything's great. No problems. But the problem is that maybe this doesn't happen. So maybe instead, thread 1 starts running, it gets the lock for directory A, gets the lock for directory B, and thread 2 starts running after that, it tries to get the lock for directory B, it waits until after thread 1's done with B, then it waits for A, thread A releases that, and we're done. So that's also fine. So we can have it at the same time. But sometimes, we're going to get a little unlucky. So these were two of our, what I call our lucky cases, or arguably are unlucky cases, depending on your point of view. So these, everything went fine. But sometimes we're gonna have something else happen, where these happen to go at more close to the same time. So thread A starts, then thread B starts. So thread A locks A, thread B locks B. Then thread A tries to lock B, but it can't, because thread one tries to lock B, but it can't because thread 2 has it locked. Then thread 2 tries to lock A, but it can't because thread 1 has it locked. And, well, thread 1's waiting for thread 2 to unlock B, but we know that's never going to happen because thread 2's waiting for thread 1 to unlock A, which we know is never going to happen. And so they'll never reach those unlock statements that we're waiting for. And that we had to have this exact precise timing shows you why we're talking about this deadlock as a problem, because it's pretty subtle and you often won't notice it most of the time. It's the kind of bug which just happens sometimes, you know, after things are running for a while. And it's really hard to test for, therefore. Like, if I want to test that my move file method is safe, not only do I need to think of testing this scenario, moving A to B and B to A, I need to think of testing that enough times to make sure I eventually triggered this exact timing. Because I'm going to run a lot of times and get one of these lucky timelines, either this or something like that, where there's no problem. And again, we can represent what's happening here with this sort of graph of dependencies. That here I'm saying I have a line from thread 1 to directory A. Thread 1 is waiting for a lock on directory A. And that lock is held by, in the sense that we know thread 2 got the lock, therefore it's going to unlock the lock if things work normally. thread 2, which is waiting for a lock on directory B, which is held by thread A, and we see we have this cyclic dependency, which will never be resolved. Everyone's just going to keep waiting forever. Okay, some questions on scenario? Yes.
We just had to talk about sort of running threads in order, sort of way.
Yeah.
Couldn't that help in this scenario?
So if we could guarantee the threads would run in this sort of order, one at a time, yes, that would help. And maybe if we could find a way of making sure this happens, we'd avoid this problem. But the point of having separate threads, presumably, is that we want, in the cases where they aren't where they're like the directories are different, like if it was A, B, and C, D, we want them to actually run at the same time. You know, so if we just enforce we're going to do only one directory move at a time, that would solve the deadlock problem, but then we wouldn't be taking advantage of having multiple threads for moving things, moving files. Yes?
Would we be able to resolve the issue by making the threads get the locks in the same order? So making thread 2 get lock A and then lock B?
So the question is, can we resolve this by being careful about the order in which we acquire the locks? And the answer is yes, and we'll talk about that a lot more later. First, I'd like to mention sort of an extension of this. So this is the scenario I've dealt with. And a strategy which won't work that you might think of is, well, we should never allow someone to move A to B while someone's moving B to A. But we can have more complicated circular dependencies. We can have a case which involves three threads. And this is even more difficult to test, because now I need to run three different moves at the same time and have the timings all work out exactly right. So the idea is we move A to B, B to C, and C to A at the same time. And we have this case where thread 1 is waiting on thread 2, which is waiting on thread 3, which is waiting on thread 1 again. And as proved, yeah, well, one of our solutions for this will be careful about the order in which we acquire locks, and we'll show why that fixes things later. Okay. So I showed you these deadlocks with locks and also with pipes. Deadlocks with locks are probably the most common case, but this type of problem is not limited to resources that look like locks. There are other kinds of things it can happen with. So one example is, let's say we had a malloc function, which when there's not enough memory, it just waits for more memory. That seems like a useful feature if, like, I'm running a lot of things on a computer. I just, you know, want to wait for other things to finish up and free up some memory. So here I have two functions which use that. So I have allocate 1 meg and wait for it, allocate 1 meg and wait for it, do a calculation, then free it, and thread 2 does the same thing. And if we have, say, 2 meg of free space, then this can deadlock with an unlucky order, that we can have this happen. That even though we have 2 megs of space, because thread 1 and 2 have committed to 1 megabyte of that already, that no one's going to actually finish. And this would be probably the sort of thing where we usually would discover that everything's fine, because as long as thread 1 allocates all its space quickly enough before thread 2 gets to go, thread 2 is just going to wait. So this is another example of deadlock. So I've given you examples of deadlock. I'd actually like to give like a definition. So deadlock is the circular waiting for some sort of resource. And resource is a very general term, because we see this problem with lots of types of things. So most obviously we saw it with locks. So locks are a resource that a thread has or is waiting for. We can also have threads, say, waiting for CPU time, waiting for disk space, waiting for memory, waiting for pipe buffer space. Those are all resources. The key thing about resources is that, for the purpose of this, is that some thread has it and other threads don't. And I note that deadlock is different than starvation. So we talked about starvation earlier with respect to schedulers. We said that we didn't have these schedulers like strict priority scheduler, where sometimes a thread would never get to go. But deadlock is a different problem. So with starvation, we have some threads which don't do anything, but someone is making progress. So the key thing about starvation is that there's a winner. Someone is actually getting to go. If you think about our priority case, that high priority thing which isn't being starved, and there's always one of them, gets to go, and there's the low priority things which don't. With deadlock, everyone involved in the deadlock doesn't do anything. Like, there's no winners in deadlock. So another thing about starvation is that there's a fix for starvation which doesn't work for deadlock. For starvation, we can say, okay, this thread isn't getting the resources it needs because it's being delayed. We can take churns to resolve it. So if we say, there's some starvation happening here, I'm just going to run the threads round robin now, that will fix starvation. For deadlock, that will never fix deadlock. The threads can't do anything, you can't run them. Okay. So given that we know what deadlock isn't, let's talk much more formally about what deadlock is. And there's four requirements we're gonna talk about, and talking about these is going to help us figure out what are ways we can systematically make sure deadlock doesn't happen, prove that we're not going to have deadlock. So one of these requirements is mutual exclusion, that we have to have resources that are one at a time. If everyone can get the resource, it's fine. So like if you think, if we're like have reader-writer locks and everyone's trying to read, there's no deadlock problems with that because everyone can read at the same time. We have to have hold and wait. So a necessary condition is that a thread that's waiting for something must also be holding a resource that some other thread might want. If we can prevent that from happening, we know we never have deadlock. And in the examples we saw earlier with, like our producer-consumer, our reader-writer lock, this we only had one lock, so there was no holding and waiting. While we held that lock, we weren't trying to wait for another lock. We always released the lock and waited on a condition variable instead. We also need to have no preemption of resources, that the reason we have deadlock is because when we know that we're waiting on someone else, we can't just take the resources from them. They have to give them up voluntarily, such as by unlocking a lock. And finally, we need this circular wait, that when we draw that graph of who's waiting on who has what resources, that we have a cycle, that some thread is waiting for another thread is waiting for another thread, which is waiting for the first thread. We need to have that loop among the threads. If we don't have that sort of cycle, that's what's happening. That's not a deadlock. Yes?
Does a deadlock need all of these things? Or just one of them?
The question is, does a deadlock need all of these things? Yes. And these are all attributes which we're going to need to call something a deadlock. So we can look at all these things, and if we can get rid of any one of them, we know we don't have a deadlock. And this can give us several ways of preventing deadlocks. And sometimes they'll be practical, sometimes they won't. So let's start with mutual exclusion. If we have infinite resources, so everyone can get it all, there's no deadlock. So if you think about our memory case, if we have infinite memory, and even if we have allocated, no one's waiting ever, we don't have a problem. Every thread has their own resources, so if we have no shared resources, every thread has their own directories, you can't have deadlock. So this is useful, kind of, but doesn't apply to many situations. Like, usually if we have multiple threads, we have some shared data, and usually we don't have infinite resources that we can just give every each thread their own copy. So another thing is we could attack the idea of holding and waiting. That we could say, instead of waiting, we're going to have the equivalent of a busy signal. That you're going to say, abort and retry. That, say, rather than acquiring a lock, you try to acquire a lock, and if you can't get it right away, you just give up and release all the resources you have. That gets rid of hold and wait, and that will prevent deadlocks. And that's one way of preventing deadlocks. And you can think of this, if who's had ever seen had a busy signal? I might be too old. Busy signals? No? Couple. Okay. Telephone systems. Back when we didn't have answering. Yeah, I forget that that is not a good example anymore. Or at least won't be in 10 years. So the other thing, which was mentioned earlier, is that we can acquire resources in a consistent order. And this attacks the circular waiting. So it's a little subtle why this works. But one way of thinking about it is if you think of those graphs I had, saying that we acquire them in a consistent order says that we can lay out the resources, the nodes that represent them, in some order, and lines always go forwards. That's what we're saying by doing a consistent order. Because we always acquire, say, from left to right, and our acquiring makes a line in that direction. So we have a consistent order, yes?
So would that mean, like, in the example of a new file, that, like, you would have to acquire files, like, in alphabetical order or something like that?
So the question is, in move file, how would we implement that? So let's look at that, yes. So here's our move files. So we have our from dir and our to dir. So instead of doing this, we want to do this in a, you know, some sort of choose an order. So we have to choose an order, and it doesn't actually matter which order we choose so long as we always choose the same order. So one thing we could do, probably the simplest thing, is we could say, well, from dir and to dir have addresses. Let's just take the one with the lowest address. Another option, like you mentioned, would be if we look up the name of FromDir and the name of tutor, we can just sort them alphabetically, choose the alphabetically first one. So the order, what exactly the order is not the important part. It's just important that we're consistent so that we know we aren't generating those loops, that we're always going to have things go in the forward direction, you know, when we lay out our graph. And we're prohibiting us from having someone trying to do this connection. So another option that would prevent deadlock would be to request all the resources at once. So this is going to be avoiding hold and wait. So if we can, instead of lock A, lock B, if there's some operation which is simultaneously lock A and B, if we could somehow implement that, then that would prevent the deadlock because we never have someone who doesn't only has half the directories they need to wait on. Okay. So let's give some examples of some of these. So there's no waiting is one that's worth talking about. So this seems like a little bit of an exotic strategy. So how would we implement that? I'll give an example with sort of what happens with our malloc. So I talked about an example of deadlock where we allocated a megabyte of memory or waited for it to be free. We had deadlock there. If we do what our normal malloc does, which is allocate a megabyte of memory or give up and return an error, then, well, we don't have deadlock anymore. In our unlucky scenario, instead, this allocation fails, and maybe this allocation fails. Right, yeah. And something else happens. So we don't have that sort of scenario. So the question is, what do you do when, I guess I didn't, no, right, so this allocation fails, then this allocation yeah, fails because we have 2 meg allocated. So this fails, then this fails, then we free up that first meg and try again. So this avoided the deadlock. No one's waiting forever, but no one made any progress. And a good question is, will this stop or not? So that depends on what our reaction to it failing is. So if our reaction to it failing is just that we're going to print an error and exit, then that's our what happens. So we've turned deadlocks into just failures. Another option would be to try again. And that's a common thing you might do. You might say, okay, maybe there's some megabyte of memory free now, but we could have the same scenario happen again, possibly an arbitrary number of times. That problem is known as a live lock. It's not deadlock because it's a case where if people took turns, we would resolve the problem. Because we don't have that holding and waiting. Okay. But malloc is sort of a real example of not doing the hold and wait for a shared resource, which is memory on your computer. That we at least avoid deadlock because we give up instead. And you can react to that giving up by trying to allocate the memory again or crashing your program. You've probably usually done crashing your program, but you've never had a case where multiple programs were waiting for more memory and they all were hanging because of that. So another example that goes beyond hold and wait is what we'll say is preemption. Let's say instead of allocator wait or allocator fail, we have allocator steal. That if I don't have, if there's not a megabyte of memory free, I'm going to steal it from someone. So thread one allocates a megabyte, allocates another megabyte. While it's not free, that's okay. We're just going to kill thread two to free that value-added allocator. So you might say this seems awfully impractical. Some systems do things like this, but there's obviously big practical concerns. And the biggest concern is you can't just kill something and expect things to be in a consistent state. You need some more systematic way of figuring out how do I stop thread two. But if you implemented that, or if you didn't care, you could do this type of avoiding deadlock where you just say, we're going to give it to you anyways, taking it away from whoever owns it. And that's getting rid of the hold and wait property that we required for deadlock, that no longer can thread two hold those resources indefinitely, or no longer will thread one be holding a resource and waiting for someone else. It's instead going to take those away. So it's not going to wait. So you might say, well, I showed you this with memory. Can you do this with locks or other resources that we might come up more often? It might make more sense, kind of. So pthreads for the fail option has something called trilock, which is like lock, but instead of waiting, it just returns an error. So it's lock or fail. So that exists in pthreads. Using it intelligently is very hard, but it exists, so if you wanted to do that sort of thing, you could. As for the steal option, this is not really something pthreads does. Pthreads has something called cancellation, which you can kind of arrange to do it, but it's pretty complicated. But this is a real strategy that's used even with locks. So some databases implement what are called what we would call revocable locks, where they will avoid deadlock by, in cases where something is waiting too long, they'll just say, this query, which is has all these locks, is taking too long. I'm just going to stop it, make it release all its locks, so I can run this other query. And databases can get away with that because they carefully written all the code that implements the queries to make sure that's safe, to make sure that's not going to put things in an inconsistent state. They have a real way of making the lock go away and making sure all the resources related to it are restored before it finishes. Okay. Also, I alluded to the issue of live lock. So I'd like to just show an example of that. So with abort and retry, which we absolutely can implement, this is a concern. So here's my try lock version of my move file. So I try to get the lock in the first directory. And if I get it, I try to get the lock in the second directory. If so, I'm done. Otherwise, I release the lock in the first directory and try again. I need to release the lock to give someone else a chance to acquire that lock because they might be waiting for me otherwise. And then I do my operation. So this is my try lock version of that. So this avoids deadlock, but it might have this opposite problem known as live lock, that we could execute this loop forever if we just get unlucky every time. Now, probably this won't happen in practice because eventually our scheduler will schedule things slightly differently, so we'll be not quite synced up. So either thread one or thread two will get both locks. Problem. But there's not really a guarantee. So this problem is known as live lock. It's not deadlock because we don't actually have threads waiting. They're in fact just using all the CPU, trying to acquire locks, giving up, and trying again. But no one's making progress, and potentially no one's making progress indefinitely. So that's live lock. And some systems do implement this strategy, and they have to deal with live lock. So there are like some different strategies you might use to do that. So one example is you can make the schedule random. So if you just do some random waiting after you kind of get a lock, that's one way of avoiding live lock. Another idea is you can detect, oh, threads are doing lots of this trying and aborting. I'm just going to run them one at a time just to fix that. So some systems really do this, but it's not very common. Okay. Yeah?
So those techniques, would that require some sort of communication with your scheduler, or how is that actually?
So the question is, how do we do this? So this option, running them one at a time, requires your scheduler to cooperate, probably. Or some extra code with respect to how do you, what you do, some like shared data structure you check after you can't get a lock. This first one is actually very simple to implement. You just generate a random number, sleep for that long. And it's probably the most common technique in practice if you're concerned about live lock. So you might say, we talked about revocable locks, that no one does that. I said databases do it. Another example is that Linux does this for memory. This is actually how Linux's memory system works. Linux overcommits memory, so it just allocates more memory than the program's supposed to have. And if it's wrong about that being okay, it just steals memory by killing a program. Problem solved. And that's an example of preventing deadlock. But Linux has promised a program memory, but it now promised more memory than it actually needs, that if that actually comes to pass, that programs are waiting for more memory, it just kills one of them to stop it. That's an example of a real use of the allocate or kill the other thread. Is this a good idea? Depends who you ask. I would note that some people recommend turning this feature off on servers. Okay. Now, our most consistent way of dealing with deadlocks, and what I would recommend you do in practice almost all the time, is not these keep trying over and over again and aborting techniques, even though sometimes they're a better option. But if you can, try to just acquire the locks in a consistent order. So we've mentioned one way of doing this is, you know, choose an ordering, so you can compare pointers, you can compare directory names, you just need to make sure you choose a consistent order so everyone acquires in the same order, so no one, we don't have circular waiting. We always have, you can go forwards and say, I'm waiting on A, then B, everyone's waiting on A, then B. We never have, I'm waiting for A, then B, I'm waiting on B, you're waiting on A, loops. In any ordering will do, you just need to choose an ordering. And this is by far the most common strategy in practice for preventing deadlocks. And it comes up all the time. So for example, here's some comments from the Linux kernel. And the comments are showing, hey, we have this code here which needs to acquire multiple locks because we have a really complicated system with multiple things that have locks. And here's the order we have to acquire them in. And they just have this documented in a comment, and when you write code, you are responsible as a Linux kernel developer for making sure you lock things in this order, that you lock, in the case in the bottom, slab mutex, then a nodes list lock, then slab lock of page. And because everyone's doing that, we know that we're not going to have a deadlock, assuming everyone follows these rules. Any questions on this? And this strategy is what you'll see in most real code bases. The case where you wouldn't use this are things like I mentioned databases, where maybe it's too complicated to figure out all the code which acquires locks. So if you think of databases, like they need to acquire locks like for an SQL statement, which could be basically anything, that's a reason why they don't sort of predetermine. And use, might use some of these other strategies we talked about. But if you can do consistent order, it's definitely the simplest to implement. It doesn't have any live lock problems. You just need to do some planning work to make sure that you're keeping things in the right order. Okay. So any questions about consistent order? Okay, so our final option was requesting all the resources at once. So this is also often practical, and it's generally what people actually do for things like disk space or memory, that you say, I need this much disk space and memory to install this program or I'm not installing it, right? That's sort of the reasoning we'll do as a system administrator to prevent that kind of deadlock. And you could do this in practice if you have some extra information. So one thing we could say is, I can tell you when I start each thread, this is the maximum resources it might need. I just need to give you a maximum, it might be conservative, and we just only start threads if all those resources are available. And this might be a real thing you might do on something like an embedded system where, like, you know, there's these things connected to my system, I'm just going to carefully plan out what threads can run at the same time by knowing that the shared resources we have, you know, they need these resources. I'm not going to start the thread at all if those resources aren't all allocated to it. And this is another way of preventing deadlock, that we just effectively acquire all the resources or don't. We don't have this piecemeal thing, so no one's holding and waiting on resources. Okay. So I've talked a bunch about deadlock is and what it is. Let's talk about deadlock detection. How do I know if I have a deadlock? And let's say I want to do this programmatically. So let's say I have my mutex implementation. I want to modify it so it will tell users, hey, you have a deadlock right now that involves mutexes. What should I add to my thread and mutex implementations? What information do I need to do this? Yes. So who's waiting on this lock? Okay. That seems like a good idea. So what are we going to do with that information? Or is there any other information we need? anyone? Yeah. So a way of thinking about this is when I previously showed you deadlocks, I showed you graphs like this. So one way we can detect deadlocks is you can just try to produce this graph. And so far, we have the information about these solid edges, because you tell me for every mutex, we're going to hold who's waiting on it. But I also need to know who has each lock, so I'm going to add that. And then I can actually produce this graph by iterating through all the mutexes in the system. Might need a list of them somewhere. So, you know, so this is what mutexes do I have / waiting for. So given that information, I get my list of all contained resources, and I just draw that graph I showed you earlier and look for cycles. So we can draw our, here's a thread, here's a lock, thread is waiting on a lock, another thread has that lock. So we can draw this graph and find out if there's cycles in it. We can find out if there's cycles in it using topological sort you learned in 2150. And so that's actually a thing that you could do. Yeah?
So would that look like just some extra logic in the lock step? Or would just upon lock, check for cycles, and if there's a cycle, exit?
Yeah, so that would look like, yes. So while locking, we would say, what's the graph look like now? Is there a cycle? Do it. In a practical system, it's probably more likely that you'd like only run this if threads weren't doing anything for a while. Because the nice thing about deadlock is you know that that means you have a bunch of threads which were waiting for a long time. So you could only run you could only actually do the expensive detection when it was possible. Yeah?
So like, what we had multiple commands and the graph got like super complicated, it's like that first search or thread first search, like in fact the algorithm would detect
So, the question is, what algorithm do you use if the graph is super complicated? The algorithm you want to use for just finding cycles is something called topological sort, which from 2150, we're not going to go over it, because this is not a graph algorithm, of course, and we won't have you implement this. I want you to understand the conceptual idea, which is basically something based on depth first search, is the simplest way of doing it. Okay. So this is something that some real applications do. An example of why you do this is if we talked about aborting things that are hold locks, this is actually how they do it. They don't just say, you have the lock right now, I'm going to kill you. They say, you have the lock right now, and I'm deadlocked because of that, I'm going to kill you. So they only do it when there's a problem, and that makes it more practical because we aren't getting rid of people's locks all the time and killing threads. We're only doing it when things go bad, which is going to be uncommon, hopefully. Okay, so this is our sort of idea of resource allocation graphs. We're just going to draw these, where we have an edge from a resource to a thread if a thread owns the resource, and an edge from a thread to a resource if it's waiting on it. This is how we represent the possibility of deadlock. A tricky case with this is when we have divided resources. So this algorithm works great for locks, where a thread either owns the lock or it doesn't. But then we have things like memory. Memory, like we have thread 2 has 2 megabytes of memory, and thread 1's waiting for 2 megabytes of memory. If thread 1 was waiting for 1 megabyte of memory, everything would be fine. But it's waiting for 2, and that's the problem. And this doesn't work so naturally in that way, because the existence of a cycle between these boxes doesn't tell us what's going on. Because thread 1 can take any of these 3 boxes, we need to know that it's because it needs 2 of them at once that we have a problem. So there's a little bit of an extension of cycle finding we can use in this more general case. And the intuition here, and this is going to be a lot worse than depth first search, is that we want to just look at all the threads and try to simulate progress. And the idea of progress is that if a thread like has everything it needs to go, then it's just going to finish and it's going to release resources. If a thread is waiting on resources that are free, it's going to get those resources and finish. So we're going to simulate that, and we're going to keep doing that. We're going to look at every single thread and say, is the thread only waiting on things that are free? If so, let's pretend it finishes, simulate that, and try again. And we're going to do that until we find out no threads can do anything right now. And if we get to that state, we know that there's a deadlock. We know that even if we give threads that are waiting on things, everything is free. We give threads which aren't waiting on things the chance to finish, that we would still have waiting forever. And so the algorithm, might look something like this. So I have my resources where I have an amount for each resource that I track for every thread. So every thread has resources it owns, resources requested, and we have some free resources in the system. And I have this as sort of a map because we have like an amount of memory, an amount of this lock, this lock, this lock. All our resources are represented in this way. For locks, like the amount is 1 or 0. For memory, it's like a number of megabytes. And our algorithm is we go through all threads that are still that have resources in some way or waiting for resources, and we see, is everything they requested free? Which includes the case where they're not requesting anything. And if so, we say, well, in that case, we could run this thread, let it finish. And if we let it finish, then those resources are freed up, and we can see what happens with the other threads. And if we don't have a deadlock, doing this should eventually free up all our resources and let all our threads finish in our simulation. And when no thread needs to do anything, we know we're done, and we just say, are any threads still running after we simulate that? If so, we have a deadlock. So questions so far? I'll go through an example. Yeah.
Aren't there any lucky or unlucky cases when we're simulating this process? Could there also be false positives?
So questions, can there be false positives or false negatives? So because of the way we're simulating, it might be the case that in the real system, that deadlock wouldn't end up occurring because of the order things ran in. But it's always the case that there was a potential deadlock. There shouldn't be false positives, because assuming we're only looking at things which are currently waiting on a resource, right? If we were looking at things which would potentially be waiting, it would be different. But since they're currently waiting, we know they're already waiting, so there's not going to be any false positives, except that we only are keeping track of the resources the threads currently have. So we don't know about things they might request currently, they might ask for in the future. So that's the main false negative issue, is that we only will detect those deadlocks later. This is only, do we have a deadlock right now? Not, are we going to have one really soon? So to give an example of what this looks like, here I have a case which isn't a deadlock. Because here, thread 1 is waiting on 2 units of A, and thread 2 has 1 unit of A. So that should be fine. So what's going to happen in our algorithm is we're going to say, okay, if all the resources requested by a thread are free, it gets ownership of them. So we say thread 1 gets these 2 resources. And then we say, if a thread is not requesting more resources, we pretend it finishes. So we assume it's going to finish. And then we do the same thing again for thread 2. We say thread 2 is requesting 1 unit of B, it's now free because we said thread 1 finished. So it now, we say it gets that. Then we say, does thread 2 we learn that thread 2 is not requesting any more resources, so it finishes. And then we're done, we find out there's no deadlock because we could finish all the threads in this way. So questions on what I went through here? Okay, so this is an algorithm for more general deadlock detection for the case where we have split resources. And something I'd like to mention about using this is that a thing you can do is you can use this algorithm for prevention. So the way you use it for prevention is instead of saying, what are the threads waiting on now, you say, let's pretend the threads were waiting on all the resources they might need. And if you know there's no deadlock, if they were all waiting right away for all the resources they might need, you know there will never be a deadlock no matter what happens. So this is an example of sort of, it's kind of like the request all the resources at once idea, but instead of like really doing it, we're just saying, is there going to be a deadlock if they requested all those resources now? And leave it at that, which is going to let us do a few more things at once than we would be able to do otherwise. So I think that's all I have. So questions on this topic before I finish up? And I'm sorry, I'm over time. Okay, so that's what I have on, this is the on deadlock detection. So next time we'll talk about, we'll review this and then talk about things that are alternatives to threads and then about virtual memory.